Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by Mobius Strip Press. I am G.R. Mobley. If you go to my site, reclaimingtherepublic.org, you will have access to my content and support documents and links. This is an educational grassroots program leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. Let me see how much I can squeeze in about 1.5 minutes, because that's how much time we have. We have a, it's kind of like an interview for me. We had Eric Levy on, and he is a member of the NLA, is part of the leadership group and so forth. And he's just getting exposed to Republic Review. So he had a bunch of questions. So he's not necessarily a listener. So there's a lot of things that he hasn't heard, but the questions that he has are, I think most people have. And then sometimes if you don't, you know, hear it in a perspective or in a way that makes sense to you, sometimes, you know, we need to hear it a special way, so, you know, that bell rings or that light comes on. And so what we're going to do is he's going to unleash some questions that he has for me so that he can understand what it is we're doing and more details about the Constitution and so forth. So we're going to be having a very long interview, and actually we couldn't get all the questions in, so we'll end up having them back. But that will be coming up as soon as we, you know, come back from the break, which is just, you know, we're going into the break in just a couple seconds. So as you know, we have Red State Coffee out there. If you want to support us, go to reclaimingtherepublic.org and you can order your Red State Coffee, or you can also contribute with our GoFundMe campaign. Anyway, we're going into the break and we'll be right back with Eric Levy. God bless, and we'll be right back after this. Thank you so much. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with Republic Review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model, on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. That number to dial in is 215-TOP-TALK, 215-867-8255. And again, don't forget those three C's. And if you're ready to call in, the lines are open. All right, folks, we are back. And we actually have Eric Levy. Is that correct? Am I mispronouncing that?
That is correct, yes, sir.
Okay, so we have Eric Levy, and he is a part of the NLA leadership team, and we kind of crossed paths, and he started asking me some questions. And I think the questions that he asks are kind of typical, and I believe you've listened to a few of my shows, right?
Yes.
Okay. And some of those shows have kind of sparked other questions and some interest and so forth. So I thought that it would be a good opportunity to try to address those questions. So, because most people think the same way, most people don't, and not most, I should say, everybody has, like, so many of us are, you know, really tactical. We learn with our hands, we learn by doing, but some people learn by listening, some people learn by reading. And so we all have different ways, but there's lots of people that need to hear things in a different way. And I believe your questions will force me to say something in a different way. And in essence, the intent is to try to help those who need to hear it in a different way be able to get that that little bell resonating in their head going, ah, I understand now, because it was approached or presented in a different way. Anyway, so what is it that you do with the NLA, Eric?
I am a national coordinator, and I basically just do volunteer work that I've done for a number of years now. I've volunteered on our welcoming committee, and we welcome new members, and we try to get them going in the free courses, and one of them we do charge $5 a month for. The courses that we have on the Constitution and the Bill of Rights and government by consent, these courses, a militia course. And then I also help with paperwork, non-judicial foreclosures, and habeas corpuses. I don't know how familiar you are with the issues with our courts, but wow, they sure are a mess. And what we're doing above all else is building pressure within the courts with our paperwork. As you know, we don't have much enforcement yet, but that's what we're building up to. And I just want to say that one of the things, in two very important ways, you and your work, you mesh up really well with NLA, and those two ways are that we both agree, and as far as I can tell, and I've been with NLA over 6.5 years, on the fact that a constitutional convention is not something we need, and it's really a dangerous thing, in fact, and it will not solve our problems, and also that the militia is the enforcer. And that's the enforcer that we need to bring compliance with our Constitution. So anyway, I just wanted to get that point out there, because I think we mesh up real well.
Okay, great. well, folks, let me just cut to the chase, because there's a few questions that are probably, you know, beg some details and some thought matter to answer these. And so the first question that you asked was, and I really pared it down a little bit. The CDC is just another agency, just like the energy, Department of Energy, and many other unconstitutional roles, responsibilities, and powers. Because there are four clauses in the United States Constitution that has been used as portals for the federal government to usurp power. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to pull up a few of some of my favorite citations. But more importantly, what I'm going to actually do is put things in context to the Department of Transportation, because I'm not sure, you've probably never tuned in when I covered the initial attempts of creating the Department of Transportation.
No, I have not.
Yeah, okay, so that's okay. The intent here is to, you know, provide you the, you know, what I'm going to say is the academic evidence necessary so that you, you know, it's a closed issue for you and everybody that listens, that these clauses, and what are the clauses? The clauses are the general welfare, or the general defense and welfare clause, the commerce clause, the necessary and proper clause, and the supremacy clause. Those four clauses have been used, and the general welfare, or the general defense and welfare, and the commerce clause are probably the two that have been used more often than not in, you know, such as the Obamacare, such as some of the taxation. I don't know if you ever heard of Wicker v. Filburn.
I think I have, but go on, please.
Yeah, that was a 1943 court decision, and I really don't like citing court decisions, but it's a historic decision where a farmer who was growing wheat only for, so the cost of wheat was going up, or grain was going up, and he actually had livestock, and he didn't grow wheat to sell. He was growing wheat to feed his livestock because he had the acreage to do so. So he goes, you know what? I'm not paying anybody to grow something I can grow, and I'll save myself my cost on that. Well, the federal government came in and said, hey, you got to pay taxes on that. And he goes, why? I'm not selling it. And he goes, because you've removed yourself from the market space we can tax you on that because you should be consuming and paying the tax. And it actually was ruled in favor of the federal government being able to tax a farmer or taxing somebody from being removed from the market space. And I'm surprised that they haven't used those draconian tactics on other things. But anyway, the more important thing is is that we try to cover some of the empirical data. So the CDC says that the federal government has the authority and jurisdiction through the Commerce Clause in the Constitution to, you know, to be able to usurp power. Well, in the ratification debates, they didn't necessarily cover the Commerce Clause to the nth degree like they should have. However, in Madison's first attempt, or I should say Congress's first attempt with James Madison as president to create the Department of Transportation, Madison vetoed that bill. The little backstory on this is that Congress, is, or I should say friends of Madison who were in Congress, came over right before he retired, and they said, President Madison, you have done so, you know, so much good work, and we want to create the hallmark legislation to kind of, you know, let you go out with, you know, big bang that you've created this legislation that's been great for America. What could we do that would be great for America? And so what he did was he answered the question, what would be great for America? But he didn't say that it was something that he could just do. So he basically started telling them, because if you understand, most of these men had read Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations. And in Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations, he identified the United States as an economic powerhouse if we could improve, or if we could tap our natural, you know, waterways and our and channels of distribution so that we could move our commerce more efficiently than any other state in Europe. We could literally bring products to bear more efficiently, more rapidly, and actually become the number one economic entity in the world. That was Adam Smith's view. And so James Madison said, well, the one thing we really need to do is we need to improve our infrastructure so we can move our commerce, you know, from our raw goods and, you know, refined goods, both to the hinterland, which is the inside or the interior of the United States, out to the ports and overseas and back. And so they ran off and they gave him a bill. And on March 3rd, his very last act of president, he vetoed that bill and he sent a, I don't want to say an admonishment, but it was a veto message that literally said, we have no power. As much as I want to sign this, I'm constrained by my obligation as the president of the United States to support and defend the Constitution. And so, and I don't know if you've had this bill yet. Did I ever send this to you?
Are you talking about the,
Madison,
the veto?
Yeah, the veto, the infrastructure bonus bill, right.
Yeah, the bonus bill. Yeah, I read it and it was wonderful. Yes.
Yeah. So inside that, he actually does touch on these four clauses. He says you can't use the Commerce Clause to create this power. He says you can't use the Necessary and Proper. You can't use the Supremacy Clause. He actually mentions all four clauses that we just touched on, the general welfare and, or general defense and welfare, and the other three that I just already mentioned. And so he points out that these powers are not portals to, you know, creating new powers that you have to amend the Constitution. Well, he did it in such a way that you have to have a really sharp mind understanding how he presented that information to put it into context. The more powerful message was actually by James Monroe. Did you get that one?
I don't think I got the Monroe one.
Okay, no. So Monroe's is actually better. And so they did the exact same thing in 1822. Monroe was on his second term. And they said, well, let's see if we can get Monroe to give us these powers. So they sent a bill to Monroe, and it was a Cumberland Gap type of power. And the intent was to be able to do some maintenance and so forth of highways and waterways. But what it was going to do, it was going to be able to allow the federal government or the general government to tax the states you know, for whatever they needed to do these types of maintenance. So even though it was labeled an innocuous, you know, Cumberland Gap repairs or infrastructure repairs, something like that, it actually was going to create and create a permanent power into Congress. And so this is what James Monroe said. And if you want this, I can send it to you. But this is really powerful. He says, if the power exists, it must be either because it has been specifically granted to the United States or that it is incidental to some power which may have been specifically granted. In other words, is it a part of taxing, you know, by apportionment? No, it's not anything to do with that. Does it have anything to do with the militia? No. So if you look at the enumerated powers, is there anything? So what they tried to do was they tried to use the Commerce Clause. They tried to use the Post Roads. And do you know what a post road is?
I believe I do.
Okay, tell us what a post road is, because this is great, because most people don't know what a post road is.
Well, maybe I don't either, but the post roads were to be provided by the general government, and this is my understanding of it. However, they weren't necessarily supposed to take over the communication or the delivery of the mail. But they are to supply the post roads across the country. Now, do I have this wrong or?
So, yeah, a post road is supposed to connect a state's capital to the general government's capital, to Washington, D.C. So, in other words, okay, they have a responsibility to, you know, to try to ensure that there is a maintained. You got to remember back in those days, you know, maintenance of a road. I'm trying to remember, you know, how many fords it was that Thomas Jefferson had to cross. And it was, you know, a lot. He actually, you know, blurted it out that, you know, he had to make all these crosses. And as a matter of fact, in Thomas Sowell's Black Rednecks, White Liberals, he actually mentions how there was a huge difference in highway improvements in the South compared to the North. But a post road is a road that is actually connecting from a state capital to the seat. And that's why if you look at a map of the United States of highway systems, you'll see like a star, like a hub spoke highway system that actually connects all these highways going into D.C. And so they've used a lot of, license in trying to connect, you know, like from Seattle to go all the way across to Chicago, and then with Portland, Oregon. And so in other words, there's a lot more interstate highways going across than probably necessary. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, you know, they've done that. But there's no call for interstate highways going north and south or in directions like Interstate 15, Interstate 5, and so forth, where you have these highways, these interstate, federal interstates that have no connection whatsoever to D.C. So anyway, a post road was that requirement that the federal government was going to ensure the lines of communication, because that's what those were, to be open and accessible for the people. So anyway, bringing this into context, he goes, it has never been contended that the power was specifically granted. It has been claimed only as being incidental to some one or more of these powers, which are specifically granted. The following are the powers from which it is said to be derived. First, from the right to establish post offices and post roads. Second, the right to declare war. Third, to regulate commerce. So right here, he just mentioned the clause that the CDC is using. Fourth, to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare. Another clause that is the mystical clauses. Fifth, from the power to make all laws necessary and proper. Another mystical clause. So he's listed all four mystical clauses. And proper into carrying into execution the proper or the powers vested in the Constitution in the government of the United States or in any department or officer thereof. Sixth and lastly, from the power to dispose of and make all needful rules and regulations respecting the territory and other property of the United States. Now, this is James Monroe, and I want to put this into context. James Monroe is a framer. He was a debater in the Virginia ratification debates. He was an anti-federalist as well. And he actually voted against ratifying the Constitution. So this man understood, you know, what was being said, what the Constitution could do and what it couldn't do. And this is what he says. According to my judgment, it cannot be derived from either of those powers, nor from all of them united. And in consequence, it does not exist. Having stated my objection to the bill, I should now cheerfully communicate at the large reason on which they are founded, if I had time to reduce them. And he goes on and on, because he actually wanted, just like James Madison, there's too many Jameses, James Monroe and James Madison both wanted to see this. Even President Andrew Jackson wanted to see this power vested into the federal government so that they could make these roads and maintain them and so forth. To be clear, he vetoed it and said that those powers do not exist. Now, here's the point. If the powers to create, and you know, there's these incidental powers associated to post roads, incidental power, well, the rest are the mystical clauses for the most part. And so, but at least with post roads, that is actually an enumerated power. And he vetoed it. Where in the Constitution is there some incidental thing regarding regulations of health and vaccines and diseases and that type of thing? They have no enumerated power over anything within the, I mean, for them to even exist, they are unconstitutional, period. And the fact is that they're trying to be able to manage and dictate and regulate under the Commerce Clause is laughable. Because even right here, James Monroe, a framer, and I can get into the ratification debates, and as a matter of fact, probably one of the most important ratification debates, and let me see if I can actually pull them up for you, because I want to say it's highlights. Because James Monroe, or not James Monroe, James Madison was probably the most succinct and most accurate in trying to, you know, put things in the least few words. And it was difficult for people to extrapolate some of the stuff he said. But this is what he said regarding the jurisdiction of the United States. And this is on June 6, page 59. And he basically says, quote, the powers of the federal government are enumerated. It can only operate in certain cases. It has legislative powers on defined and limited objects beyond which it cannot extend its jurisdiction. So in other words, if it ain't listed, they can't do it. And as a matter of fact, Mr. Nicholas of those same debates actually went on and said, you know, he made a comparison that the king, if it's within the general powers of the king, then he has the power to do whatever he wants to. But with Congress and the United States government, they're held to those specific powers. And so it comes down to this, and this is the best way to put this into context for people. If you look at a power of attorney, everybody understands a power of attorney. If it is a general power of attorney, then it is up to the discretion of the person that has been granted those powers to do whatever they want to do because they have all general powers. If it is an enumerated, a specified power of attorney, in other words, this is the only power that you have, then that's all you can do. And as a matter of fact, it was James Iredell in North Carolina that used the power of attorney, and I can send you that. I think you have the debates, but if you look for power of attorney in that document I sent you, it's really a powerful argument because he says, has anybody ever heard that somebody was given the power in a power of attorney to sell lands for a person in one county that person could assume that they could even, because it's the same thing. It's a power to sell land, so I can sell these other lands for you in these other counties that you own, right? Absolutely not. The power of attorney is very specific. You can only sell those lands. And it's the same thing with the Constitution. It's very specific. There was the framers were so scared of general powers that they made sure they did everything they could to limit those powers to the very specific needs of national security, the ability to tax to be able to support the needs of national security. And that was it. And that's why the militia became so important. So I didn't want to languish too long on this, but this is this one topic, this one usurpation and using these types of clauses has been shenanigans that have been going on for well over two centuries. And it's unfortunate that people do not understand how the Constitution was defined and sold to the states.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. And I mean, it's dizzying. It makes my head spin to think how far away we are.
Right.
How far from center we are. I'm sure you've considered this, but because Madison and Monroe mentioned these four mystical clauses, as you call them, mm-hmm. Do you think that's why the evil empire has focused on them so much to use them? Do you see the sinister activity there?
Well, so if you go through the ratification debates, and I can give you the highlights that I've extrapolated that I share with my audience all the time. I go through these exact same things all the time. And as a matter of fact, what I sent you, if you look, if you view that with a navigation pane up, if you have Windows Office 2010 or newer and a navigation pane, you can see how I use the headings of 1, 2, and 3. You'll see note, or you'll see impeachment and these, and you can go straight to that and read the highlight that I provide my audience. And you go, wow, that's really powerful. Militia, note, or... And you can go in and add your own granularity to it. But for the most part, when you start looking at how they went through the necessary and proper clause, that's one of those things that I'm actually going to write an article about that actually nails down how Congress's ability of exclusive legislation only has an impact. Even the anti-federalist George Mason agreed that they only had the ability to legislate for within the District of Columbia. Here's the interesting thing. George Mason was saying, well, they could conjure up such evil that it could infect and corrupt the entire United States. Yeah. And like casting a spell or something like that. I mean, it was getting into almost theatrics when they were trying to, you know, get people to not ratify this because we needed a Bill of Rights. And that's what it all stemmed on. The anti-federalists hang their hat on this concept that we needed to have a Bill of Rights. And I've actually taken the position as in going through the, and I challenge you to do the same thing. Go through these things. Just go through the notes that I've highlighted, and that should be more than enough. And you're probably looking at maybe 30 pages, so it'll take you a little while. But I'm telling you, if you actually read the arguments against the Bill of Rights, you'll realize when you back out to the macro view and you look at how people talk about Constitution and it's a violation of the Constitution, they only point to the Bill of Rights. They never point to Article 1, Section 8, Subsection 15, that Congress shall have the power to call forth a militia to execute the laws of the Union. You know, that is a very, very important and specific power that has been vested in the militia. But most people, if you're only looking and focused on the Bill of Rights and the negatives that were placed in addition to the enumerations or the specific powers granted, you're going, well, why? It made people lazy and it made people think, well, they can't do these things. Well, what about the ex post facto laws? How many states have been passing ex post facto laws? All of them. Yes. And it's a violation for both the state and the federal government to do this. So anyway.
Okay. So, yeah, I mean, that's a lot of stuff. okay. So. What I really want to get to, and I mean, all this stuff is very fascinating. And I love the anti-federalists are my favorite. I really like that federal.
You know, and let me just say this. Let me say this because I've dealt with a lot of people that just love the anti-federalists, and they said the anti-federalists were right. No, they weren't. The federalists were correct. What Madison said, and what Nicholas, and what all these federalists, Iredell, what they said was actually 100% right. The problem is that when Mason got up and made the assertion that these things are going to happen, yeah, if they happen, that means that they're violating the Constitution.
Right, right. I agree, and I see the value, of course, of the Federalists. But let me tell you what, you read the Federalists, and they were a little theatrical themselves.
Oh, you mean the Federalist Papers, or?
Yeah, the Federalist Papers, yes.
Oh, okay, okay.
I mean, you can see they're really trying to sell it. You know, they say such things as, oh, the American people would never allow for this, they'd never allow for that. And, you know, I think I can hear it in their voices.
Hyperbole.
Yeah, a bit right, of the, right. Yeah, exactly. Right. But no, I agree, of course. And if you just simply make them comply with the Constitution, we'd have no problems. I mean, we'd have very few. But hey, that brings me to my questions. The other questions, the militia and corralling the media. I mean, I know you.
Okay,
you
let me get. I'm ready to dive into the militia now. This is really simple to me. The militia is an organization that is broken down by county, and it is manned by apportionment. There is an organized militia and an unorganized militia. The unorganized militia is all citizens. The organized militia are those who are required to be able to maintain the peace, because if you read, and I know you've got this, and I just can't wait for you to read this, the debates back and forth on June 14th, June 16th, 13th, 14th, and 16th. This is where they really focused in Virginia on the militia. And when they go back and forth, there was a point in time, I think it was, Clay something. Anyway, he was saying, you know, what is this, you know, this rebellion or what have you? And Madison starts alluding to a riot. And he basically says that if there comes a point in time where the sheriff, you know, cannot, you know, quell an uncivil rest, or I should say civil unrest, I mean, then he should be able to call upon the militia. And if not, then he should be able to call upon the state militia if it is too big, you know, like the sheriff of a large metropolis. And so, and one of the things that Madison was pointing out was, is that, the reason why people could be rioting is because they don't like the law and the enforcement of the law. What was the very first thing that the people didn't like when Washington was president and they passed a new law? It was the taxation on libations, and it caused the whiskey rebellion. Hey, people didn't want you to get their fingers in your pocket, you know, in their ability to consume, make, manufacture, and sell libations, whiskey, and so forth. And so there was a huge uprising. You're not putting your fingers into this. And George Washington, did he grab the Marine Corps? No, because the Marine Corps did exist at the time with the Navy. So he didn't grab the only standing military entity. In their day, the militia was the army.
Yes.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, and you were saying before, I believe, that there was no distinction made between the militia and the army. Were you not saying that?
Yes, correct. That is correct.
Okay.
But the militia is broken down and organized throughout the state. When you look at the National Guard is just, you know, they need so many people. And, oh, by the way, not everybody is actually, the whole control of the National Guard is maintained and managed while they're at rest. It's still handled by D.C. It is not controlled by the states.
Yes, correct. Right. And that was one of my questions, too. I get upset when I hear this talk about the National Guard. But let me ask you this. The organized and the unorganized, do you see the unorganized broken down into two or three different divisions, or is it just all one?
So it is the last bastion of protection from tyranny. So the bigger question is, why did they choose a militia? Because the militia is we the people. The brilliance in this, and this is in one of my articles, What is the Real Problem? The brilliance is so divine Because when it comes down to a tyrannical law, who is going to enforce a tyrannical law upon themselves and their family, their neighbors and associates? Who's going to do it?
Exactly.
They yes. knew that the people would be the last stand against against unrighteous, unlawful, unconstitutional, tyrannical types of laws. If they wanted to create a Sherwood Forest out of the middle of the United States, maybe we'll call it Yellowstone, then they steal the land, because throughout these debates, they talked about this stuff, that how the king would steal land, and that's how he would steal the wealth from the people. And so, go ahead.
No. I've actually been to Sherwood and Nottingham. All right. So the last bastion, and then the organized militia. Let me get to this one. I have so many questions for you.
Okay.
The organized militia. Do they have, who, aside from the leaders that they have within the militia itself? You know, they're going to have officers.
Uh huh.
Do they respond specifically to the governor, or if the sheriff did from a certain county need the state militia, if things got too out of hand, would he first have to go to the governor, or could he call them up himself?
So the sheriff should be able to call them up himself. As far as the organized militia, there are organized commanding officers for Lightfoot or whatever the militia is for your county. If it is an organized militia. However, the states do not recognize and deploy. So here's the thing. If you have an organized militia, then it is being armed, equipped, and trained and standards provided by the federal government. Because what's subsection 16 in the Constitution that talks about the militia?
You're talking about the one that's the clause that's specifically for our general government, Congress?
No. So here's clause 16 of Article 1, Section 8. These are the enumerated powers. The Congress shall have the power to, right? 15 is Congress shall have the power to provide for calling forth the militia to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions. 16. Congress shall have the power to provide for organizing, right, arming, and disciplining the militia. The states still have the responsibility of creating who the officers are, appointing the officers, and so forth.
Yes. Okay. So the sheriff should not have to go to the governor. He should be able to go directly to the organized militia.
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
All right, and that was another point that I made in my questions to you, was that another thing that rankles me about the National Guard is that these things that you've just been talking about, what group of people are going to enforce tyrannical measures against themselves? Well, no group of people is going to do that. So that was my point, is that the National Guard, they don't even think like the militiamen. They don't have it's an entirely different mindset.
They have become mercenaries. They have become mercenaries.
Yes, exactly. Precisely, yes. As Brent Winters says, I remember him talking about the Filburn case now that you mention it. As Brent Winters says, the militiaman is protecting what is behind him, and the military man, including the National Guardsmen, are thinking about what's ahead of them, and that's specifically more about their careers.
Right.
And so, yeah, it's an entirely different mindset. Yeah, and that upsets me.
So the way you say it so nonchalantly, it's almost like you've become immune to all this upsetness.
I wish.
Let me move on to your next question, though, because I if you want to linger more and really dive into the militia, I would just say you read those first, because I think all the information is there for you, and then you could probably formulate, you know, some other ideas. But too many people put way too much credence in all we have to do is restore the militia. We can't get there from here. We have to actually have the state legislatures do a full audit And then at that point, the state legislatures should, all of these state legislatures should then recognize that this federal government is violating the Constitution. Because bottom line, what is the EPA? What is the DOE? What is the Department of Forestry? These are all nothing but enforcement agencies. So this concept of protecting us from having a standing army per the Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, Subsection 15 that I just read, I mean, that was the galvanized protection that the federal government could never enforce their own laws. And then all of a sudden, they've created a multitude of standing armies over these different bureaucracies.
Yes, yes, yes. And what is it, over almost 6,000 statutes that are unconstitutional at this point? It's 5,000 to 6,000.
Well, you know what? No, as a matter of fact, it's not for me and you to even come up with the numbers. I just tell people that if you look at the spending, if you just look at the fiscal side of this, 85% easily, if not more, is going on unconstitutional spending.
Yes.
Okay.
Now you're saying, okay, I understand what you're saying. The militia is not going to solve all the problems. But you're saying the first step has to be the states must bring, through auditing, through Republic Review, the general government into,
yes,
compliance.
Correct.
Okay.
Because when the states actually – who are our sovereigns? Now, if you tell me it's just we the people, then you don't understand American government. Because it's not we the people in our legislative bodies. We are, so first off, we're a representative government, right? A Republican form of government, which means we have a representative form. Now, in the constitutional, and if you probably heard my interview with Brent Winters.
I only heard some of it.
Okay, that's okay. Mr. Sherman, the Sherman Compromise, or the Connecticut Compromise, was an epiphany that changed Republicanism for America, unlike Republicanism for the rest of the world. We recognized, and this is why we have bicameral legislative bodies, we recognize that we actually do have sovereign governments. We delegate very specific powers to our state government, to our county government, and to the general government. And therefore, we need to have representation, or that body needs to have representation. Why is it that there's only one chamber in Congress that actually reviews treaties, and it happens to be not we the people? Because the people who have the greatest stake, or I should say the entities that have the greatest stake over treaties, are the states, which is why the Senate had that responsibility. Why did the House have the responsibility of declaring war? Because they were the representatives of we the people, those who had to go fight and die. And so they made sure that they distributed the roles and responsibilities as appropriate for the sovereignty of that representation. So the states were sovereigns, and the counties were sovereign. This is why every single state, I believe there were a couple of states from the original 13 colonies, there were a couple that had bicameral legislative bodies, but not all of them. Every state, after the U.S. Constitution was galvanized and coagulated, took form, and they, you know, started moving to New York, this is why every state had conventions, and they reformed their legislative bodies into bicameral legislative bodies. And the Senate represented the counties. For several years, for several decades, the Senate was representative of the counties. As a matter of fact, in the state of Wyoming, their constitution states that the Senate will represent the Senate, our senators, are representatives of the county, not of the people.
Excellent. And so the 17th Amendment destroyed all of that.
So technically, no. And this is there's people that, you know, just look at, oh, this is the one thing. And the one thing is compliance. I try to keep people on the track. It's about compliance. The 17th Amendment only changed how the senators were to be selected. It didn't change the powers of the Senate. But what it did was it undermined the influence of the sovereigns who they were to represent. Because there's this old adage that I'm sure you've heard, he who pays the piper calls the tune.
Mm-hmm.
And So those who are buying those Senate seats are the ones who have control. There's a huge difference between the state legislatures calling that tune, because right now there's not one state legislator, or I should say legislative body, that I could call, stand in front of and say, are you happy with how your senators are representing you and your state as the sovereigns of this state? And they'd all say, heck no, are you kidding? They don't even listen to us.
Yeah, and that's my point. Precisely.
Right. I get that. The process has undermined all of that because they're following the money. Right. Absolutely. But it didn't change the fact that, the states still have the final authority over any amendments. It didn't take the state's powers away from stepping in and saying, federal government, you have no authority to do this. The problem is that the states have been in this trance, in this spell. It's like Gandalf walking into Rohan in Lord of the Kings, when the king is under the spell and he hits him with a staff and the spell is broken. He wakes up and he realizes, I have all the authority to wage war. What have I been doing? And he wakes up and he goes and fights evil. And that's the turning point, I think, in that movie. But anyway, does that make sense? The states absolutely possess the power. They just need to wake up. You hear people saying, people, you got to wake up. No, we got to wake the states up. And so people are really the problem. That's why in my presentations, I have three fundamental premises. Reasonable people, equally informed, seldom disagree. And the problem is always the middle part. We're not equally informed. The second part is that power, knowledge is power only when it is acted upon. And then the third premise, then all of these are interfolded. Once you have the knowledge and once we're equally informed and we can become succinct, then we can actually fire hose with a laser beam on our state legislatures exactly what they need to do. Our problem is that we have all of these people that are chasing their little pet peeve, whether it be abortion, whether it be a vaccine, whether it be Common Core. None of those are the problem. It is about the fact that the federal government is not in compliance, and even the states aren't in compliance. If we sent and resonated that the monotone laser beam of compliance to the Constitution is foremost and paramount, that's it, then they would be focused on that. But instead, they're trying to pass a bill to, backdoor, undermining the abortion. Why? It's unconstitutional. If they're in compliance with the Constitution, the federal government, and that ruling has no standing because it's not an enumerated power. They had no jurisdiction to make even a ruling over it. It should never have gone into a federal court.
I agree. Amen. Yes. And now, what is your... What are your ideas about getting there?
Well, so that if you don't mind, because we're at 43 minutes, going to be another story. And getting there, and so there's all these other things. So we should schedule another time, because these are good questions. But I'm going to tell you, as you read some of this stuff, remember, reasonable people, equally informed, seldom disagree. You're actually going to be coming back and saying, what about this? And I'm going, yeah, we're all this is right there. And so I do want to address these other questions before we probably move forward, too, like the freedom of the press and righteous laws and religious laws and so forth. So what we should do is probably try to, get back together. And if you want to, you can go ahead and do some reading up and we can add some more questions. I don't mind having a standard dialogue going through these types of things. But the fact of the matter is that I'm not necessarily the best in trying to be succinct. When I start talking, next thing you know, I've added a lot of different words and I go down rat holes and so forth. And so I wish I could have gotten through all of these. I was hoping that we could actually have done this in 40 minutes. So I apologize, but we do have three more questions to get through. So let's try to regroup. Let's try to finish this, and I will try to do better in staying on topic. I thought but anyway.
I think you did. I think you did too, and I think you did a fine job, and you said what was needed to be said. So very good.
Okay. Well, we will get back together, and we will do this so that I can air this, and hopefully this helps you as well, because there's no doubt in my mind, Republic Review is the only process that is going to restore the militia. It is going to restore religion. It can actually have awakening again in America if we get the government out of being able to even make pass any laws or any. It says right there in the First Amendment, the federal government should not pass any laws regarding religious expression or religion or establishing. And they've been violating that in so many different ways. But anyway, I'm going on. I thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
And I thank you for what you're bringing to the table regarding grand juries and so forth is so valuable. And when we talk again, I will even give you more information of how I think all of this is. It's like gears meshing and turning. So anyway. Thank you again.
I look forward to it. Thank you.
And God bless you. And we'll be right back once we go into these promos. But what we're going to do is we're going to cover some of the content that we have coming up. So just stay tuned. We got this one break, and then we have a really, really short amount of time to kind of give you a good heads up of what we've got still in the pipeline. So please stay tuned. We'll be right back after this. To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. Okay, if you want to join in on the dialogue, you need to call 215-TOP-TALK. That's 215-867-8255. Or you can just dial 425-270-5416. That's up on the website. So by all means, give us a call. You want to have questions, you want to have some dialogue. The best way to do it is actually call our office line, 425-270-5416. Anyway, with that, what we want to do is we want to kind of give you a heads up of, you know, what's in the pipeline. We're going to get into the Tory Acts and the cod fishery bounty debates between Livingston and Madison. We're going to get into some highlights on the Federalist Papers. You know, I do not live, and my argument is not founded on the Federalist Papers. You hear lots of people, conservatives, quasi-constitutional conservatives, standing up, and they're using the Federalist Papers for their arguments. That is a huge mistake, because the Federalist Papers are not legally binding documents. And so, anyway, what we want to do is we want to kind of make sure, we've got a whole bunch of alarms going off, but what we want to do is we want to make sure that we actually provide you these insights. Legislative candidates coming up, they are the priority. So we will be right back after this nice weekend. So please stay tuned. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. I've been on the radio for a couple of years, and for over a decade, I have been providing content to help patriots understand what has to be done if we're going to save our Constitution and our Republic. Not one academic has been able to refute my argument for Republic Review, and even most conservative entertainers will not support Republic Review due to self-interest reasons. If you have not read my bullet point descriptions and executive summaries, you need to so that you can understand what we all need to do. I am trying to give patriots the necessary knowledge to take back our Constitution and Republic. Go to reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can read my bullet points and view the Republic Review flowchart. You can even order my executive summaries, books, and other content to understand the simplicity of what we have to do. This way, you will know what, why, and how to support the reclaiming of our Republic. Again, please take a look at my content on reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can become a part of the solution.